was a mighty nation, blessed above all of creation. It was a rare and precious pearl, conceived in faith and liberty, home of the brave, land of the free. It was the envy of the world. But this shining city on a hill has turned from the Creator's will and let evil take control. Now the reckless men who lead them want to strip away their freedom and to steal their very soul. Now it's smoke and mirrors, switching bait, criticize and confiscate, and let the guilty walk away. In this once righteous, godly nation, in the halls of education, they forbid a child to pray. They say we need to spread the wealth. They pretend to guard the health of the feeble and the poor. While the hand they hold behind their back confuses and conceals the fact that the wolf is at the door. There's an unseen hand that pulls the string. It makes his little puppets dance to every song he sings. As the night folds in on a rising tide, look beyond the shadows, behold a pale horse ride. They claim to seek a new world order, nations without borders, but don't believe the lie. Even in this wealthy nation, it could come down to starvation in the twinkling of an eye. They tell us there will soon be peace, our lives will be an endless feast, but they lead us toward the dark. In the distance, sabers rattle, and the armies train for battle as the beast prepares his mark. There's an unseen hand that pulls a string and makes his little puppets dance to any song he sings. As the night rolls in on the rising tide, look beyond the shadows, behold a pale horse ride. Righteous man to step up tall, take a stand. There is so little time. For if we fear and hesitate, soon it will be too late. We're the last hope of mankind. Time hurries on, the shadows fall, the hand is writing on the wall. But even now, there's still a chance. For
Resurrect Republic Truth Radio broadcast on RBN, folks. RTR Truth Media Reloaded. Had a little bit of a technical hiccup there. Sorry about that. The second hour, I'm going to be running for you a very important piece of information that I think everyone needs to hear this. I don't know if many folks on RBN have been exposed to Dr. Jordan Peterson. I've reached out to Dr. Peterson within the past couple days to see if we can get him on the network. I'm still waiting back from an email from his assistant. I did receive some correspondence, so we're going back and forth and trying to make that happen. But this information is too important to not share. So for the second hour, I'm going to be sharing with you Dr. Peterson's analysis on postmodernism, cultural Marxism, on communitarianism. Go ahead, Mike.
I don't think that you can understand the current situation properly without considering the role that postmodernism plays in this, because postmodernism, in many ways, especially as it's played out politically, is the new skin that the old Marxism now inhabits. So you could think that there's a postmodern philosophy, which we'll talk about a bit, that really came into its vogue in the 1970s after classic Marxism, especially of the economic type, had been so thoroughly discredited that no one but an absolute reprobate could support it publicly anymore. Even the French intellectuals had to admit that communism was a bad deal by the end of the 1960s. And what happened was that they played a sleight of hand game in some sense and rebranded themselves under the postmodern guise. And that's where identity politics came from. And so, and then that spread like wildfire from France, especially into the U.S., through Yale University, through the English department there, and then everywhere. And so what happened was, you know, there was this idea that the Marxists had put forth that the natural landscape of economic landscape is a battle. And it's a battle between the proletariat, the working class, and the bourgeois. And that that economic systems were doomed to continue to enslave people and to keep them poor and downtrodden unless there was a radical economic transformation that was predicated on something more like equity policy. And then that was put into place in many, many places, as you no doubt know, throughout the 20th century, with absolutely murderous results. It was the most destructive economic and political doctrine, I think, that has ever been invented by mankind, and that includes National Socialism, because the absolute magnitude of the havoc wreaked by the communist systems exceeded that wreaked by Hitler. And that's, I mean, Hitler didn't have quite as long a time to pull his stunts off quite as effectively, but it was a catastrophic system. And one of the things that's quite interesting is that the full breadth of that catastrophe is not something that students are well taught in our current educational system, which has always made me very suspicious. For example, the students I teach usually know nothing at all about what happened in the Soviet Union under Stalin Stalin and Lenin between 1919 and 1959. They have no idea that millions, tens of millions of people were killed and far more tortured and brutalized by that particular regime, to say nothing of Mao. So look, what happened was that by the end of the 1960s, the evidence that communism was a catastrophic failure was so overwhelming that even the French intellectuals, and we'll return to them later, like because the French have a very long-lasting and powerful public intellectual tradition, and so intellectuals there are very influential. Even the French intellectuals like Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, the famous philosopher, had to admit by the end of the 1960s that the Stalinist, communist, Maoist experiment and all of its variants, not just those particular dictators, but all of its variants, was an absolute catastrophic failure. And then what happened was the postmodernists came onto the scene, and they were all Marxists, but they couldn't be Marxists anymore because you couldn't be a Marxist and claim that you were a human being by the end of the 1960s. And so they started to play a sleight of hand, and instead of pitting the proletariat, the working class, against the bourgeoisie, they started to pit the oppressor, the oppressed against the oppressor. And that opened up the avenue to identifying any number of groups as oppressed and oppressor, and to continue the same narrative under a different name. It was no longer specifically about economics. It was about power. And everything to the postmodernists is about power. And that's actually why they're so dangerous, because if you're engaged in a discussion with someone who believes in nothing but power, all they are motivated to do is to accrue all the power to them. Because what else is there? There's no logic, there's no investigation, there's no negotiation, there's no dialogue, there's no discussion, there's no meeting of minds and consensus. There's power. And so since the 1970s, under the guise of postmodernism, we've seen the rapid expansion of identity politics throughout the universities. It's come to dominate all of the humanities, which are dead, as far as I can tell, and a huge proportion of the social sciences. And we've been publicly funding extremely radical postmodern leftist thinkers who are hell-bent on demolishing the fundamental substructure of Western civilization. And that's no paranoid delusion. That's their self-admitted goal. And I've identified, not only me, obviously, but one of the main players in this entire drama is a French philosopher named Jacques Derrida, who I think most trenchantly formulated the anti-Western philosophy that is being pursued so assiduously by the radical left. And I think its dangers can be overstated. And I also don't think the degree to which it's already infiltrated our culture can be overstated. I mean, the people who hold this doctrine, this radical postmodern communitarian doctrine that makes racial identity or sexual identity or gender identity or some kind of group identity paramount, they've got control over most low to mid-level bureaucratic structures. And many governments as well, but even in the United States, where you know a lot of the governmental institutions have swung back to the Republican side, the postmodernist types have infiltrated bureaucratic organizations at the mid to upper level, and that's actually what they're trained to do by their activist professors in university. And if you want proof of that, you can just go onto the websites of women's studies groups, for example, because they're some of the top offenders, and just look at what they say. Well, that's the issue, is that caring for someone or for a group of people is a very complicated thing. And it doesn't always mean be compassionate and feel sorry for them because they're downtrodden. It's not good enough. Like a lot of the structures that we've put in place to help people over the long run are rather harsh in their operations in the short term. I mean, so the values that are associated with trait conscientiousness, for example, which are reasonably good predictors of more conservative-leaning political belief, aren't warm, fuzzy virtues. They're cold, hard, judgmental virtues. They're the demands for performance, for example, that go along in the workplace. But if you want to take care of an infant who's crying, you want warm, instantaneous, impulsive compassion. Because there's a problem, and it needs to be solved right now, and you have the solution. Right, the baby's too hot, the baby's too cold, the baby needs to be fed. You can fix that right now. If you're dealing with systemic problems of poverty, for example, or trying to determine how to produce more opportunity for everyone to benefit from everyone's abilities, you have to use a hell of a lot more than compassion to get there. And to think of community in the positive sense as being driven by nothing but empathy, which is really one of the central arguments of the postmodern types, at least that's what's driving some of their argumentation, is it's an absurd proposition. And so it's not so much that they confuse the two things, is that they fail to differentiate the concepts to begin with. It's very, very difficult to build functional structures that help people thrive individually and socially over long periods of time. And merely being empathetic, man, that's just going to get you nowhere. A three-year-old is empathetic. And I'm not dismissing that. Empathy is important. But as a problem-solving mechanism, it has very, very limited utility.
Yeah. Well, you know, this brings me back to, we talked briefly about, you know, National Socialism, fascism, and collectivism. The difference being, from my understanding, fascism was made to control the individual. Marxism was more control of means of production. Socialism more means of controlling the fruits of production, if I'm not mistaken. And I think we've seen the destructive nature of collectivism in destroying the individual, right?
Well, I think that's actually the point in large part. I mean, Derrida, for example, coined a term he called phallogocentrism, which he regarded as the central axiomatic position of the West, eh? Not only the Enlightenment West, but also the Christian or Judeo-Christian, for that matter, West prior to the Enlightenment. Derrida went after the tradition running through Judeo-Christianity, through modernism and the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, and criticized that. And that was the idea that, and he was critical of this, it's the presupposition that culture is first male-dominated, which is a presupposition that I take great exception to because it's a radical oversimplification of the historical story. To the degree that culture was male-dominated, it was only dominated by a very small number of males. Most males were serfs or soldiers or cannon fodder, for that matter, or coal miners, dreadfully toiling away for their work. Certainly as oppressed as women were in general by the absolute poverty of the conditions. You know, up till 1895, the average person in the Western world lived on a dollar a day in today's money. Right, so I mean, you don't have to go very back very far in time before you find everyone oppressed, but not by the sociocultural system, merely by the absolute, insane difficulty of life itself. Well, so Derrida described the West as male-dominated, which I think is something to take serious issue with as as a blatant claim. It's not differentiated enough or sophisticated enough. And he also said it was logos-centric. And that partly means logic, but there's a deeper meaning to logos, because logos is also the second person of the Christian Trinity. And Derrida knew that perfectly well. And so his criticism, Derrida was a smart man, make no mistake about it, and lots of the things he said were correct. Like, one of the propositions he laid forth was that there is a near infinite number of ways of interpreting any situation or any text, which happens to be technically true. And that's been discovered in all sorts of fields, including artificial intelligence. So the central claim that he begins with is actually true. And it's not surprising that it had such a powerful effect on the humanities, because it's actually an extraordinarily powerful and undermining idea. But he took it much far. He took that idea in directions that I don't think it should have gone in at all. But the logocentric idea is that his criticism of the idea of the logocentric society is a deep criticism of the idea that the individual as a speaking force, as a communicative force, is the appropriate highest value upon which a culture should be built. He took that apart and criticized it. And so that's a deeper criticism, I would say, even than Marx's criticism, which was mostly about unequal power relationships. Derrida went deeper than that. And the postmodernists that occupy the universities are anti-individual right down to the bedrock. And so that's partly why they push collectivism to such a degree. They don't give a damn who you are. They care what your group identity is. And that's that. Yeah. Okay, so here's the claim. And there's actually people who do this professionally, by the way. They analyze businesses and other organizations by these strategies. And these are often these people, they call themselves diversity consultants, for example. Okay, so here's the claim. Imagine that you take a hierarchy of some sort, like a law firm, a big law firm. Then what you do is you analyze the hierarchical structure of the law firm. Then you break down the representation of the people in the law firm by their identity categories. So how many men, how many women, how many transsexuals? But then you don't stop there, eh? And this is actually part of the technical problem with the approach. You divide them by race. You divide them by ethnicity. You divide them by sexual identity. Okay, so imagine there we've got six categories already, six or seven categories. Now, of course, obviously race is further divisible, as is ethnicity, as are such things as attractiveness, right? So there's all sorts of ways of dividing people into groups axiomatically, and there's no self-evident way of determining which of those group divisions should be superordinate. And that's partly how the leftists, the radical leftists, can keep gerrymandering the game, because they can just keep playing games with the group categories. In any case, you take the organization, you take the bottom hierarchy, and you say, the bottom rung, and you say, okay, well, is it 50% men and 50% women? And if the answer to that is no, then you make the claim that the reason for that is because of systemic oppression and prejudice. Oppression, prejudice, bigotry, and usually misogyny. Then you make the case that the people who are organizing the organization are bigoted and misogynist, even if it's not consciously, unconsciously, so that's the unconscious bias aspect. Then you put forward a plan that can include quotas, and increasingly will be, to ensure that that hierarchical level is now equal in proportional representation to the population itself. Now, of course, conveniently, you also get to determine which population you're going to compare it to, because that's one of the ways that you get to keep the power when you're doing this. You get to decide which groups people are going to be identified with, even though there's a near infinite way,
we'll be right
number
back
of ways
Dr.
people
Jordan
could be divided.
Peterson, Resurrect the Republic, Truth Radio Broadcast, RTR Truth Media Reloaded. Thank you.
homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
For the past 14 years, it's been my privilege to host the National Intel Report on RBN, to offer a platform to interview exceptional guests, to provoke critical thought, and examine evidence, whether real, fake, or somewhere in between, and allow our audience to call in and participate with your input and questions in order to help us all reach an educated decision and arrive at our own truth. Our world has changed. It's now been turned on its head. Real is now considered fake, and mainstream fake is now pushed as real, rather than any clear thinking, consensus, or rationale.
Those few remaining beacons of light, the ones still shining through the mainstream media lies, propaganda, and deception, are being viciously attacked at every level through attempts at censorship, threatening advertisers, jailing hosts, and even killing journalists brave enough to speak the truth to you. We are in a war for our very freedom and existence, and through these despicable acts, freedom haters, collectivists, and communitarians have shown they will stop at nothing to blot out these last few beacons of light. Truth is becoming increasingly more difficult to unmask, just as the term unmasking itself is spoken by those usually anonymous sources. They promote their lies, wishing to mask the truths by ignoring it, vilifying it, or conspiratorializing it into a black hole abyss.
Regrettably, RBN has reached the tipping point, and through internal audit and actuarial review, it has now been determined that the only life raft of survival to this network is to go the way of PBS, that being audience supported. Like a cornered animal, the left with veracity is pulling out all the stops with every effort to effectively blacken our beacon forever. Help us, folks. Help yourselves. Don't let our light stop shining. Our motto has always been, because you can handle the truth. It's time to review your budget, folks. If you want the truth to keep flowing through RBN, go to republicbroadcasting.org and become a regular monthly donor of 30, 40, 50, or 100 or more a month and ensure you keep the truth flowing.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Jordan Peterson from Resurrect Republic.
Even though there's a near infinite way, number of ways people could be divided into groups, and you get to decide which population you're going to compare it to. So you can keep everybody unstable and off kilter permanently with that sort of approach. Well, then you go into the organization and you make anti-unconscious bias training, for which there is zero evidence for the utility of that intervention from a scientific perspective. In fact, some of the scientific evidence suggests that if you make unconscious bias training mandatory, you make prejudice worse. And maybe that's because people don't like to be called bigots and misogynists and to be put through retraining in a mandatory way. Okay, so then you do that. You do that in analysis at each rung of the organization. Now, you might say, well, why do you do that? Well, the putative reason is equity. Now, equity and equality of opportunity are not the same thing. If you hear someone utter the word equity, either they don't know what they're talking about and they're ignorant beyond they're ignorant in a manner that makes it inappropriate for them to engage in a conversation about it, or they are the enemy of anyone who holds the tenets of individuality dear. Because equity means equality of outcome. And so the real postmodern radicals are using community to mean equity and equity to mean equality of outcome. And so then they get to divide up the groups into whatever groups they feel are the groups that should be people should be divided into now. And then they get to go make their claims of oppression and misogyny and bigotry and all of that. And one of the huge advantages that accrues to them in doing that, and since it's all about power, is power. And that's the game that's being played out. And that's happening unbelievably quickly. It's the equity issue is something that's it's absolutely unbelievable to me how rapidly people have started to talk about equity and to actually think that that's a reasonable goal. Now, the alternative is to let people sort themselves out more or less in a free market manner, allowing for the possibility that there are genuine differences between people in intelligence, temperament, and interest, and for which and the notion that those things differ and that a tremendous amount of that difference is a consequence of biological underlying biological reality is overwhelming. And the humanities types, the postmodernist types, they know they've lost the scientific battle over this. The whole idea that people are a blank slate and that everyone's equal at birth and that everything that makes people differ is a consequence of socialization, that bloody idea has been dead among anybody who's reasonably educated as a scientist. That's been dead since, I would say, mid-60s. Dead. It's not, no one even talks about it. But among these postmodernist types, man, they don't give a damn for facts. In fact, facts for them are merely whatever the current power hierarchy uses to justify their acquisition of power. The people who are animated by the postmodern ethos are not generally in and of themselves thoroughly possessed postmodern philosophers. First of all, they don't know enough about postmodernism or its underlying Marxism to make that claim. Imagine that the philosophy has an impetus. It has a core tendency to move in a given direction as a body of ideas, a coherent body of ideas. And then imagine that it's represented in fragments among people who find its tenets palatable. So most student radicals, for example, are not 100% committed postmodernists. They're probably only like 10% committed postmodernists. When they're not being foolish with their mob, they're out being normal people. But if you get a mob together that's animated by that postmodern ethos, then the collective spirit that animates the mob has that power-seeking proclivity and that antipathy towards Western ideals that we've been discussing. I think it's what makes that different, let's say, from what was happening in the Soviet Union at the beginning of the Russian Revolution, is that there was a organized group of conspirators, Lenin at the head, whose goal was to overthrow the monarchy and to seize power. And that isn't what's happening here. There isn't an organized group of people who are getting together and saying, well, you're going to lead the assault on Western civilization and we're going to produce a new government out of the ruins. It's nothing that explicit and articulated, but the end result is much the same. And it's happening, well, I think it's already demolished the universities. So I think actually irreparably, I think whatever the universities are going to be in 15 years, especially on the humanities end, will bear almost no resemblance to what the universities are now. Right? The purpose of those so-called disciplines is to produce radical postmodern activists who will reshape the political and economic structure. In fact, that's part of the coursework. It's like, that's what they do. The discipline isn't based on the acquisition of abstract knowledge. They're activist disciplines. And, you know, I use women's studies as the core example because I think it's most obvious with women's studies, although all the ethnic gender studies pseudo-disciplines that have emerged.
We'll be right back after a few words from our sponsors, Resurrect the Republic. Everything you earn by breaking your backs. We're gonna redistribute when we make our pay tax. Hey, sit the count, don't be a jerk.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Okay, nurse, let's get this man to the ER stat.
Right away, doctor.
We see this every day. Heart attack or angina pain due to blocked and clogged arteries. Chelation can remove obstructions or blockages from arteries and help avoid painful and expensive surgery. Now there's Angioprim. It's a liquid oral chelation product that you take with juice. You start to feel the results fast. Angioprim increases blood flow all over the body, and that means more energy and strength to take on the day with less aches and pains. 60 years of research has gone into chelation, and Angioprim is the result. A safe and easy way to unblock your veins and arteries from buildup that slow circulation.
Paging Dr. Jones, please report to the emergency room right away.
Log on now for a special radio offer from Angioprim. That's angioprim.com/radio. A-N-G-I-O-P-R-I-M. Angioprim.com/radio or call 877-882-7221. That's 877-882-7221.
Many people write us about their experience with Extendivite. Allow me to read you some from Amazon.com. This product is superb. I have been taking it for about a year now, and I can feel my cardiovascular system run like a Swiss watch. I definitely recommend this product for anyone that has high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and heart palpitations, A+. It's potent, but it works. I have been waking up for the past 3 years with numb hands, and a week into using Extendivite, my numb hands seem to have cleared up. My circulation was off, and now it's back on track. So I'm happy. I feel so energized, and I have my husband on it now. My mother-in-law has cholesterol problems, so I bought her a bottle as well. Thank you so much. Love the product. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
This is too good to be true, except this time it is real. 100%. No joke. How about a $25,000 membership to Front Sight Firearms Training Facility as a thank you bonus for a one-time donation to RBN of only $500? It is a Commander Lifetime membership with no yearly fees or dues. The training is free for the rest of your life with over 50 different classes. Then leave it to your designated beneficiary. You provide the approved firearm, holster, ammo, eye, and ear protection. Many features and bonuses are included, more than you would ever expect or believe. This is the ultimate graduation present, wedding gift, etc., etc. See the details. Go to RBN's webpage and frontsight.com to make it happen. May 5th is the last day you will hear this offer on this radio network. Help keep RBN alive. Tell 5.
Mother of the moon, which built my sails, rose the sea of years, with no provisions.
Welcome back. Resurrect Republic radio broadcast, RT Archer Media. Dr. Jordan Peterson.
In the universities over the last 30 years are all bastard children of exactly the same enterprise. But even more appallingly, that ethos has moved out into disciplines that at one point had some genuine value. Anthropology, that's a good one. Sociology, social work, education. Education is done. The faculties of education are so corrupt that it's almost unimaginable. They might even be worse than, as a societal segment, they might even be worse than the women's studies groups, because they've seized the educational systems. I mean, I've just been reviewing the Ontario Teachers Federation, ETFO, I think it is, EFTO, Education Federation. I'm sorry, I can't remember the acronym. Doesn't matter. It's a document that's produced by the main teachers organization in Ontario. And I've just been starting to review their curriculum for children from kindergarten to grade 8. It's pure social justice postmodernism. Jesus, they even teach kids to, here's how you interpret a book if you're a postmodernist, like a fiction book. You don't read the book and try to understand what utility might be extracted out of it to guide you in your life. That's the old system. The new system is you read the book and you analyze it in terms of whose societal position of power it justifies. So you look for who the supremacist is in the text. Could be could be the author, it could be the characters, it doesn't matter. You read the text as if all it does is reflect on the current corrupt power structure that obtains in current society. And that's the beginnings of literary criticism under the social justice regime. And none of this is subtle. These people have gone way beyond subtle. You know, we have social justice tribunals in Ontario. They're named that. And the educators in Ontario, the teachers, have already decided that the goal of the education system is to indoctrinate children from kindergarten, into a radical postmodern leftist communitarian equity-oriented ethos. That's what they're doing. They're even subsuming the teaching of mathematics and science under that umbrella. And none of this is subtle, man. You just go online and download the documents and read them. And if you read them critically and carefully, well, since I've been really looking into this, which would be since last September, really starting to look at it from a legislative and policy level, I mean, the first thing I came across was the Ontario Human Rights Commission website, which is an absolute travesty. Those people are so dangerous, it's almost, you almost can't believe it. The Ontario Human Rights Commission, it should be abolished. It's a very subversive and dangerous organization, as are the human rights tribunals. Those things are dangerous. The Ontario Institute for the Studies of Education, that bloody thing is a fifth column. The people who are producing the educators that emerge from that institute, they should be put on trial for treason. Like, it's serious stuff. And the idea that the purpose of education is to get them while they're young, you know, in kindergarten, so that this radical postmodern Marxist ideology can be so thoroughly inculcated among people when they're young that they have no chance of escaping from it. And that's what's happening in the education systems. It's unbelievable. You know, every day I come across new policy statements of this sort that make my jaw drop. It's like, as Canadians, we're so accustomed to our political system working that we don't pay any attention to it. And so when you ring the bell and say, hey, there's a problem, people think, no, there's not. This is Canada, for Christ's sake. There's no problems here. You must be insane. Right? And that's the right thing for them to think. Of course, when I started talking about Bill C-16 back in October, the first wave of public response was something like, this professor is like a demagogue who's exaggerating the danger because of his own problems and for whatever reputation might accrue to him. And the funny thing about that criticism is that was the right criticism, right? Because when someone stands up in a country that functions and says, hey, guys, there's something really rotten going on here, the first thing you should do is assume that that person has gone off the rails. But the problem is that I haven't gone off the rails. That's the problem. The problem is that the problems that I'm pointing to, they're real. Like, look, I talked over the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, to, I would say, you know, if you imagine Canada's top 20 journalists, mostly in print, I talked to 10 of them. They're all terrified of speaking out about such things, say, as cultural appropriation. These are the main journalists in Canada. They're already censoring themselves with regards to what they'll print, and if they don't censor themselves, their editors will. And these aren't like, these aren't low-level people. These are people who have massive reputations, and you'd think that would be sufficient, you'd think, to protect them from being mobbed. But they're terrified. Well, the tolerance issue is interesting, because what tolerance means is, I'm stupid and flawed, and so are you, so I'll make you deal. You don't harass me too much about my stupidity and flaws, and I'll try to leave you the hell alone too. And that's a pretty good deal for everybody. So that's the tolerance issue, right? It's we're all flawed, and if we demand too much of one another in terms of perfection and unity of belief or even unity of thought or even coherence of thought, then we're going to end up permanently at each other's throats. So we should just try not to make unnecessary enemies. That's tolerance, and it's a good principle. The diversity issue, tolerance doesn't mean anything goes. That's not tolerance. That's refusal to take responsibility for mature discrimination. And discrimination has also become a dirty word. It's like there's no difference between discrimination and thinking. They're the same thing. Now, you might say, well, what about unfair discrimination? It's like, well, that's a whole different issue. It's like if you have person A and person B and they're both equally qualified for a job, there's something wrong if you let something other than their qualifications determine whether or not they should get the job. I mean, there's no one debates that seriously anymore. You know, so if somebody doesn't get a job because of their race, everybody says, well, you know, what the hell's wrong with you? You're not taking advantage of the person's talent. You're doing society a disservice, and you're hurting individuals unnecessarily. You shouldn't do that. It's like, okay, fine. We all agreed about that back in like 1965. That's covered. So, but the idea that anything goes with regards to tolerance and lack of discrimination, that's an entirely different thing. That does not mean that all people are the same, or that all abilities are the same, or that everything is of equal value. And so there's a big difference between tolerance and nihilism. And so lots of people say tolerance when they mean, well, anything goes, I can do whatever I want, I don't have to be responsible for anything, I don't have to think, and there's no difference between people no matter how they act. It's like, sorry, that's not a philosophy, man. That's a recipe for chaos and disaster. And then the diversity thing, it's like, oh, I see, we need more black people on our board because all black people think the same way. That's how we're going to play this, is it? We're not going to be able to think. So it's such a pernicious philosophy because it's predicated on the idea that the way someone thinks is inextricably tied with their group identity. Well, that's what the bloody racists used to think. You know, well, no, we're not going to invite, let's say, Iranians into our culture because all those Iranians think the same way. Well, I thought that was what racism was. And so the idea that unless you have your bloody board of governors, say, or the middle strata of your organization arranged so that every single group has equitable representation, you don't get a diverse range of opinions. It's so, first of all, that's just technically wrong because it isn't racial and ethnic and gender diversity that gives you diverse opinions. That's just an idiotic. That's just a, I don't know how you could be, I can't understand how you could be so uninformed historically and technically that that argument would make sense to you. But apart from that, it's clearly, see, the bloody postmodernists, they're always criticizing what they call biological essentialism. So if I say, well, look, you know, on average, women have a different set of interests than men, which they do, by the way, and that's not sociocultural. They say, well, that's biological essentialism. That's wrong. But then when it comes to race, they're perfectly willing to say, oh, well, you have to have an equitable representation of all the different races because otherwise you won't get the proper diversity of opinions. It's like, well, hold on a sec. Is race a biological construct? And you don't get the bloody diverse opinions without them emerging from this underlying biological construct? How is that not biological essentialism? And it's biological essentialism of the worst type. It's, and having said all that, I would also caution people against making the assumption that what the radical postmodernists say they're after has anything to do with what they're actually after. Because they're not after equity. They're not after tolerance. They're not anybody's friend. Not at all. They're power. They're after power. And that's it. And they use all this compassion language, which is like, you just have to scratch the surface of that and you find out how fast that vanishes. They use all this compassion language and I'm on the side of the oppressed, all of that posturing. It does nothing but mask the underlying drive to power. And that's in keeping with their own damn philosophy, because for the postmodernists, there is nothing but power. But there's an idea that emerged in the West, and the idea is that the state is regulated by the ethic of the individual. And so that the individual has intrinsic value, and that value is predicated on the recognition of the individual's capacity to generate order out of chaos. And that's the identity with God that was implanted, so to speak, in human beings at the beginning of time, according to our founding let's call them mythologies. There's something about that that's right. Now, if we lose that, we're going to suffer for it, man. We're going to suffer for it. And I've studied totalitarianism for a long time. I know what happens when things take a viciously communitarian twist. It is not pretty. And, you know, people think our society is more, even the radical leftists who criticize it, think that our society is more robust and impervious to subversion and danger than it actually is. It's actually not. It's actually, we could lose it a hell of a lot more easily than we think. And it's got all sorts of flaws, and like, criticize away, but with a bit of gratitude, that would be nice. It's got all sorts of flaws, but we don't have anything better to put in its place. And when we've tried, we tried a couple of different variations in the 20th century. Man, and that did not go very well. Now, if people want to bring that back, it's either because they don't know what happened, and they probably don't, because generally speaking, people's historical education is so dreadfully inadequate that it's actually, it's like a crime. Or they don't care, and what they're aiming for is trouble. And neither of those things are good. So, you know, I've been watching this politically correct thing develop for 3 decades. You know, it's popped its head up here and there. It happened really in the 1990s, in the early 1990s, but then it sort of faded away to some degree. But right now, man, it's back with a vengeance. You know, in Bill C-16 in Canada, that's going to pass. And that is the first piece of legislation ever put in place in Canada that compels speech. And the justice minister curses on her head. The justice minister is refusing to, and her coterie of minions, are refusing to implement a perfectly reasonable amendment that was proposed by Senator Don Plett to reword the Canadian Bill of Rights to ensure that Bill C-16 doesn't interfere with free speech. And they refused to do it. Why? Because equity trumps everything. Equality trumps everything. That's not good, to put it simply. That is not good. And so people need to wake up and see what's happening. And they need to start watching what their children are being taught. That the new policies of the Ontario Teachers Federation, as I said, I've got the acronym wrong, those should be scrapped. I would tell people, do not send your children to public schools. If you're going to send them to public schools, you better bloody well keep an eye on what they're being taught. And I would say that's particularly true for communities of relatively conservative immigrants and minorities. You know, I mean, historically, they've been aligned, say, more with the Liberal Party in Canada because of its more tolerant attitude towards immigration. It's like, it's time for those relatively socially conservative ethnic immigration communities to wake up and realize that the people that they thought were their allies are not their allies at all. So, no, we're going too far down this road. It's not a good idea. And it's happening a lot faster than people think. So, it's time for people to wake up. Jesus, you know, I've talked to the conservatives, the leadership, many of the people who ran for the leadership federally. I've talked to the provincial conservatives in Ontario. The provincial conservatives were too afraid to have me come and talk to their caucus. Think about that. They think I'm too... Because, you know, their theory, this is Patrick Brown's strategy, is if they just shut the hell up and hide in a corner, Kathleen Wynne will flame out and they'll win the election. It's like, well, maybe and maybe not, but that's no strategy of courage. It's like the conservative types, even the liberals, the classic liberals, have to get out there and say, look, what's happening on the radical end of the political spectrum? That is not good. We need to do something about it. But they're too afraid. The conservatives are afraid that they will be targeted as individuals, mobbed by the social justice warriors online, and taken out. And so they don't say anything. It's not even the social conservatives who won't say anything. It's like mainstream liberals who won't say anything. Well, as soon as people... So now the journalists are censoring themselves. They've already told me that. The politicians are censoring themselves. It's like, what the hell? What's going on? And it's what's really awful about it is it's a very small minority of people who are basically producing this movement forward. Probably more than about 5% of the population. So, And the other thing that's so interesting is if you push back against them hard, they just fold. I can't even get the social justice types to debate me. They won't do it. Now, they don't believe in debate, so why would they debate? They only believe in power. But like when I went to Queen's University to talk to the law students there about Bill C-16, from what I gathered, all of the law professors were invited to debate me. Now, think about it. I'm not a bloody lawyer. I'm no law professor. I'm talking about legislation. Like, a good lawyer should have been able to come out and just have twisted me into knots and sent me home in a cast. And they couldn't find a single bloody professor to come out there. So Bruce Pardee, who's a professor, had to come out and play devil's advocate. So they're not. There's no debate there. There's no discussion. So this small minority, they're well situated. They have a philosophically driven agenda. They're motivated personally by resentment and power. But there aren't that many of them, and they're bloody cowardly. And if you face them down, they'll run away. So I would say we should face them down before they continue to wreak the kind of havoc that they're already wreaking on our society. And we could certainly start with Kathleen Wynne and her coterie of radical postmodernists. So we should chase every single liberal, every single provincial liberal should be taken out of the Ontario legislation in the next election. That would be a good outcome. That would be a message. It's like, don't muck about with the structure of the family. There's a start. So, yeah, well. But the thing is, people are afraid. So the conservatives won't come out even, the conservatives won't even come out and be conservative. So one of the things I've talked to them about, and I think I talked to five of the people who were involved in the leadership convention, was if you guys are afraid to be conservative, you've already lost. You're done. Like, you're just playing out an empty game. And they are. That's the policies they're pursuing. Patrick Brown won't come out and, like, what the hell, Kathleen Wynne, she should be hanging on with one finger. If that woman had an ounce of integrity, she would have resigned when her popularity fell below 10%. But she doesn't. And no one will take her on with regards to that. So, it's not good. I can tell you one thing that I've experienced. If you're not happy with the kind of policies that your company is putting in place, or the bureaucracy that you work in, or your government, or any of those things, if you're not happy about it, and you wait, the probability that you'll become more unhappy is extraordinarily high. If you come out and say something early on, you're taking a risk. But if you say something and you don't apologize and you hold your damn position, you can chase them back. That's been my experience. You don't apologize, you know, and you don't soften what you have to say. But as far as I can tell, you've got a choice. You can wait around until things get worse and you're weaker, and you can wait till you're taken out, or you can stand up now and say what you have to say with a reasonable chance of success. That's how it looks to me. A very small proportion of extremely radical people have managed to grip the steering mechanisms of our large scale social structures. It's like, were we asleep? And the answer is yeah. That you fall asleep when things are too good for too long. So it's time to wake up, man. It's time to notice that the liberals that we're electing are not liberals. They're not even socialists. They're way the hell to the left of that. And so how did that happen? No one expected that. Oh yeah, that wasn't real communism. Yeah, we've seen a great example of that in Venezuela, where they put everybody on the kind of weight loss plan that's made the average citizen lose 20 pounds. Everyone's starving in Venezuela. It's like, hey, look, another example of what wasn't real communism. So I know what that means. I've thought about that for years. What, when someone says that wasn't real communism, here's what it means. I am so narcissistic and arrogant and so convinced of the rightness of my ideology and of my moral purity that if I was the dictator of a communist state, the utopia would have come in as promised. That's what it means. That wasn't real communism.
Good
That's
point.
That's what that means. So when anyone ever says that, you think, oh boy, I've got your number now. I know what you think of yourself. you think that had you been Stalin, that there wouldn't have been so much blood. It's like, you think again. Besides, if you would have been the positive Stalin, let's say, one of the negative Stalins would have come along and killed you real quick. So don't be hypothesizing down that road too quickly. That's what they were, the useful idiots. And then, you know, and Stalin killed all the old guard, all of them. It's like, you guys, you've done your part. All you are now is annoying and threatening. It's like, we'll just line you up and shoot you. You know, Solzhenitsyn has done a perfectly fine job of documenting Lenin and Stalin's essential similarity of character, you know, because people say, oh, well, the road Lenin was on, that actually would have been a good one, but it was perverted by Stalin. It's like, oh, no, Stalin was Lenin's slightly more evil twin. And Lenin trained him anyways because he'd set Stalin out to do all his dirty work, and Stalin learned how to do that real well. So there's no saying, oh, yeah, well, it was a good idea to begin with, and Lenin was on the right track, but then it was a cult of personality. It's like, no, sorry, guys, that isn't going to wash.
No, I don't think that's going to wash. Folks, Dr. Jordan Peterson, and I wanted to share that with you tonight because Dr. Peterson's work is very important. As some of you may know, maybe not all of you, that he took a stand against the Canadian bill that would have forced speech. It would have forced people to recognize transgender persons by pronouns that didn't even exist a few years ago, Z, Zer, Zim. This is an identity that they've assumed, like a fashion, if you will. They chose an identity, and it's delusional in that it stems from what some call gender dysphoria, which is a disorder. When you think that you're something that you're not, that's a disorder. Schizophrenia is a disorder. A long time ago, one of my girlfriend's aunt was schizophrenic, and she used to think that she was Napoleon Bonaparte. And her psychologist informed us that it would be unhealthy for us to play to her delusions because it only prolongs them. And so it was easier to do that because we met with less resistance. But ultimately, the psychological instruction that we were given by her therapist was that not to play into this delusion. Is she assuming an identity? Well, yes. Is it discriminating against her or showing her hate? No. And Jordan Peterson's work is very important. So, folks, share this with as many people as you can. We'll put the links in the description to the archive, to the Steam It article. By the way, check me out on Steam It, RTR Truth Media. Folks, that'll be all for tonight. Resurrect the Republic, Truth Radio broadcast on the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Many people write about their experience with Extendivite. Allow me to read you a few from Amazon.com. My wife and I both use Extendivite and are very pleased with the results. It has helped to stabilize our blood pressure and to make both of us feel healthier. Good product and goodbye. So far, so good. I've been taking Extendivite 3 times a day, only a short while now, but already I've noticed the circulation in my hands and feet improving. They tingle. I like the idea of taking something herbal rather than pills. I take Extendivite 3 times a day every day. I think this supplement has helped with my increased fitness regime and to lower my blood pressure. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.